You're listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast. I'm Sarah Marshall.
I'm Damien Radcliffe. I am the author of Here and Now, which is the first UK report looking at the state of hyperlocal media in the UK, which was published last month. I have defined hyperlocal as being an online news or content service which relates to a town or a village, or sometimes even as granular as a single postcode, where it's reaching and targeting a geographically defined community. And those communities are typically smaller than those that have been served in the past by TV, radio or newspapers. There's an awful lot of hyperlocal activity that's taking place in the UK.
My name's Rachel Howells. I'm a director of PortHolbertMagnet.com, which is a hyperlocal news service. And I'm also a PhD student researching the impact of the closure of local newspapers on particular communities.
She was one of seven journalists in South Wales, many of whom had been made redundant, who were talking about doing a joint project when Trinity Mirror announced the closure of the Port Talbot Guardian.
It just seems so obvious to us that we should try and fill that void, that now, you know, a dedicated local weekly paper that had a really strong voice in the community was going. It was leaving the local people without dedicated journalists in that area. And we were journalists who wanted to do something positive, you know, and to try and make a living for ourselves, really.
They started an initial site.
And that then evolved into Port Talbot Magnet, which we just felt said everything, really. It was Magnet. It was a magazine on the net, but it was a network, perhaps, that we could develop over time. And it was also, you know, a magnetic attraction. We wanted to be there for the community. We wanted to give something back to the community. We wanted to show people that news could be a positive force in the community. So it sort of said everything. And also Port Talbot is a steel town, so that it sort of had a resonance for that as well. So we launched that Easter 2011, around The Passion, which was this huge theatre production that National Theatre Wales did down here with Michael Sheen.
So how does it run?
I suppose it is done on love, really, but it's done on a few of us giving a day a week of our time, plus extra hours through the week where we update stories, we work with volunteers, we work with student journalists, and of course that all takes time. We've just now, through our involvement with National Theatre Wales, we've been able to make a little bit of money on a print product that we did around The Passion. This Easter just gone, it was a sort of commemorative event that we did the official programme for. And that's been great because suddenly we have the money and we're beginning to be in a position where we can pay for court reports now. And we've always felt really strongly that we should pay journalists for their skills.
And there are times when they can't report on what they want to.
We can't go and do endless election coverage. We can't go to every council meeting. You know, sometimes we just don't have the resources to send people. So that's very difficult for us and it's not sustainable in the long term. And one of our primary goals really is to make some money out of it. Not because we want to be rich and retire, but because it needs to be sustainable if we're going to continue.
Here's one supporter of the Port Talbot Magnet.
My name is Andy Williams, and I'm a lecturer at the School of Journalism, Media and Cultural Studies at Cardiff University. And I've got research interests in the local media, specifically the local newspaper industry in Wales.
So what are the solutions?
And I tend to think that the only sensible long-term option is going to be the injection of public money into local news provision, online, in print, while the democratic deficit is still an issue, and to help small-scale local news providers to start to develop the technology which will allow them to provide local news to younger audiences who won't be so interested in the print side of things.
Many people know of Port Talbot as that place you pass as you drive up the M4 in South Wales. I asked Rachel Howells about the demographic makeup.
Port Talbot has a population of about 38,000, something like that. The majority of people are aged between 35 and 45. But so I think they tend to be, you know, attracted to a very industrial area. So they work in the steelworks, they work in the kind of the factories and the power stations and all the industry that's in the area. And I don't think the majority of them access the internet very much. Certainly, there's a hard core of activists and people that we contact quite regularly through Facebook, and they use Facebook a lot. But I don't think, I mean, they're certainly not on Twitter. We don't have contact with, you know, the people that we have as followers on Twitter are other hyperlocals and journalists and people like that. They're not local people. So I think they're very sort of community-based. I think they get a lot of their news from word of mouth. All of this is stuff that I have to obviously verify through my research and through my PhD. But I don't think that they are people generally that go online very often, that get their news online, certainly.
With the community's relationship to newspapers in mind, and after trying crowdfunding, Rachel Howells now thinks the Port Talbot Magnet's future may lie in print.
Port Talbot Magnet entered a competition online, and we were one of two winners, and the prize was 150 copy print run of a tabloid newspaper. So that's our next step, really. We are planning on producing a printed version of our online website as a sort of trial run, really, to see how it would work in practice if we were to put what we have online into print, and to work out systems for how that will work and to find out what the pitfalls might be. But also because we want to give it to 100 people in Port Talbot and say, what do you think of this, and get some feedback and see if that's a way forward. Because last week we were in the shopping centre giving out our passion programme to people, and so many of them said, I really miss the local paper. I miss knowing what's going on in the next street. I miss knowing what crime is happening. And with the best will in the world, I think the Evening Post is doing a fantastic job. And they do, to their credit, a local edition. But it's not the same as having a dedicated local paper just for the town. And that's what we hear from people all the time, you know. The Evening Post has got too much in it about other places. We want our own paper. And there's that relationship that people have with print that I don't think they get online. I don't think we even service it. And certainly because we can't cover everything that we would like to. You know, it's not sustainable. But I think also speaking to advertisers when we were selling the advertising for our printed program, they were saying, well, we don't want a one-off. We want something regular and we want something cost-effective. But they want print. They want to see it. And we sold lots of printed advertising, and we've brought people on board that we would never have been able to get in online because we've tried. So it does make a big difference, and it's, you know, it's given us a little bit of working capital now for the first time.
Back down the M4 and to Filton, a suburb of Bristol.
My name's Richard Coulter. I have been employed as a journalist for the best part of 20 years. I was a graduate of the Cardiff Journalism Diploma. And I started my career at the Gloucester Citizen at the time of Fred West, moved on to the Bristol Evening Post, where I became chief sub and then assistant editor. And I took redundancy last summer to set up my own media company. And one of the things I do is I run a hyperlocal magazine in Filton, which is a suburb in North Bristol, which is where I live. We've been running for 7 editions now. We started as a 16-page print publication, free through every letterbox, and it's gone up now to between 40 and 48 pages. It's got all local content, all local advertising, and without getting into the numbers, it's been profitable from edition one. At the moment, I'm walking around the streets of Filton delivering my magazine. I was let down by one of my deliverers this month, so this is kind of part of the charm of the whole thing, that it's kind of going back to the roots. I described it somewhere else as the grassroots of grassroots journalism. And it means that sometimes the publisher ends up being the delivery boy. And that's exactly what I'm doing at the moment. And I'm quite happy to do it. I meet people in the street. I talk to them. They tell me things about the magazine. And I feel kind of connected to the community in a way that I never was when I was at kind of managerial level at the Bristol Evening Post.
Like Rachel Howells and her colleagues, he's struggled to persuade local advertisers to pay for online banners and buttons. His view is that print is not dead, you just need to give it to people for free and deliver it through their letterboxes.
But I don't think print itself has been rejected by people. If it's put in their hands, they'll read it.
And the Filton voice is growing.
It has increased in size and it's increased in advertising. Therefore, it's increased in profitability. And the first edition was profitable. So we started off from a profit. So I don't employ anybody. I work with a former colleague of mine who was a former ad manager. She sells adverts, and I pay her commission based on the adverts that she sells. But she has also now launched her own publication based on the same model as mine in her town, which is Keynsham near Bristol. So there are now two of these magazines around.
And from Bristol to Stoke-on-Trent.
I'm Mike Rawlins, and I edit and run Pits and Pots in Stoke-on-Trent. Pits and Pots started in 2008 in Stoke-on-Trent as a vehicle for people to have a sensible discussion about politics in the city. For very, very good reasons, the local paper has had a policy of censorship over moderation. They're there to produce news and publish it, not to moderate comments when people want to start talking about politics in the city. And this became a bit of a sticking point, certainly because Stoke-on-Trent had 9 BNP councillors at one time. I think there was something like 9 different political parties represented in the chamber. So there was no real vehicle for anybody to have any sort of discussion about what was going on. So Tony Wally initially set the site up so to sort of say, well, we'll talk about anything as long as it's polite, it's not racist, it's not abusive. And we just used to take the sort of the headline stories that were going on in the council from the paper and say, okay, well, let's discuss them. So that's where it started. And then it just sort of grew. Then we created a bit of a monster because people actually liked discussing politics in Stoke-on-Trent. We started writing more of our own content, and surprisingly, people actually read what we were writing as much as the stuff that we were borrowing from the local paper. And it sort of just grew from there. And in 2011, the Journalism Foundation popped up and said, would be interesting in doing some work around the website and how we can promote it and see where it goes, really, and see how we can help make it more sustainable.
But is it sustainable?
There are a number of levels of sustainability. Yes, it's sustainable because I pay for the hosting out of my back pocket, so it stops me being alcoholic. I could go to a football, I could do anything of a number of things, but for the £30 or so a month that it actually costs, I prefer to put it into something that's got some public and civic good. It has barely covered its costs with Google Ads and things like that. So it's never going to be a money-making machine. So could it actually afford to employ a journalist in its current form? No, it certainly couldn't. But that's not to say that we can't come up with something different to try as we go through this project, this trial, whatever you want to call it, with the Journalism Foundation, to see what does work, because it is all about, well, let's try a few things and see if there is anything that we can say, actually, if you did this, you've got a chance that you might make enough money to cover and it would only be a part-time journalist, maybe one day a week or something like that, but that's about all you'd get out of it, I think.
The Journalism Foundation recently persuaded Mike Rawlings to create a print edition.
Printing the paper was something that I was particularly sceptical about, it has to be said, because, Pits and Pots has always been online. It's designed to be online. That's how it works. So when they said, oh, well, we'll print a paper. And it is something that we had sort of kicked around in the past. It's like, should we try and put something to print? But never did because, it's cost prohibitive, really. But I was sceptical, but the Journalism Foundation said, no, we want to try and put something in print to see if that will improve the sort of people knowing about the site, improve awareness in the city. So we spoke about it and they decided that 50,000 copies for Stoke-on-Trent was about right. That's roughly the number of copies that the local daily paper sells across all of its region. Roughly every other house in Stoke-on-Trent, although it doesn't work like that, but it's, there's 100,000 houses roughly. So they said, well, we'll do an every other one kind of thing. So content was my biggest fear. So we spoke about it and we went and approached the journalism faculty at Staffordshire University and asked if their students would be interested, and they were very interested. And I'm quite proud to say that there's only 400 words from me in 16 pages of the Pits and Pots paper, because everything else was researched, written and produced by the students at Staffs Uni. So far, the distribution is still ongoing, but we've seen probably a doubling in the traffic to the site so far.
So print is driving traffic online, and Mike Rawlings hasn't ruled out a second, smaller print run of another edition of the paper. And finally, back to Damian Radcliffe, the author of the recent report into the sustainability of hyperlocals. I asked him about reverse publishing, of going from online to print.
And there have been examples of that for a while anyway. I mean, if you look in the States, you've got initiatives like Tribe Local coming out of Chicago. You've got the Washington Post doing a weekly publication of the best of their online offerings. And clearly, those products may well reach people who haven't seen the content online. And people are going to consume it in a slightly different way if it's a newspaper delivered through their door than if it's something that they're going out and actively searching online. So I think for some people, that approach, that method of reverse publishing may well work for them. And in terms of funding more widely, one of the things we argue in the paper, is that there is going to be a mixed ecology. There's going to be no one-size-fits-all solution for hyperlocals in terms of how they're going to fund themselves and how they would do it successfully. And clearly, for some people in some places, print may well be the way forward rather than digital, or it might be a combination of the two.
For more on hyperlocals, go to journalism.co.uk. You've been listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.